Okay, I don't really do planet formation, and I'm really not much of a theorist. I'm mostly here to learn, but I thought I would talk about a few, in the informal nature of these talks, talk about a few crazy ideas that I've been thinking about. Hopefully this will disarm people so they won't be too hard on me. I'll talk about three different things. One is probably the craziest idea is extremely close in planets from tidal capture. I'll talk about something I've just started, which is the idea of occultation by binary Kuiper belt objects. And then finally, I'll talk about something that might seem a little crazy, but I actually think is maybe not so crazy, which is the possibility of detecting Earth mass planets from the ground with microlensing. So mostly I show this slide to mention my collaborators, Andy Gould at Ohio State and Chung-Go Han, who's at Chungbuk National University in Korea, is now visiting Ohio State for a while. Okay, so everyone's seen this plot. This is planet mass as a function of period. The black dots here are known extrasolar planets detected via radial velocities for the most part. One thing that's very obvious from this plot, which we all know about, is that there seems to be a very interesting feature, which is we see planets up to periods or down to periods of 3 days, and then what seems to appear to be a pretty sharp cutoff where there's no planets below that. Up until a year ago, this was the state of the of this plot, and everyone came up with wonderful theories for why planets should migrate into 3 days periods and then stop. And some of these theories at least seemed to be pretty pretty compelling, and everyone was happy. And then came the Ogle planet, which was detected via transits with Ogle, and then followed up with radial velocity observations by Kanaki et al. And this planet has a period of 1 day. And even if you didn't believe it at the beginning, now there are more radial velocity observations, and it seems pretty clear that this planet is in fact real and is sitting at a period of 1.2 days. So whatever mechanism you had for stopping these planets, which I'm not sure if Dimitar Saslov calls a parking mechanism. I'm sure he's not the first one to call it that. It says it down here somewhere. For whatever mechanism you had to stop them at 3 days, you now have to explain why, in this case, it stopped at 1 day instead of 3 days. And you can probably come up with a way to do that, but one thing that's sort of hard to understand is there's nothing in particular about this planet or the population that it comes from or its parent star that would lead you to expect that it should be any different from the planets that are being found around local stars. It is farther away, but it's in the galactic disk, has similar metallicity, it's a solar mass star. There's no particular reason, nothing changes that much in the galactic disk that you'd expect it to be that different. So sort of parallel to this, the discovery of this planet, I was thinking about another idea, which is what are the effects of planet formation in stellar systems? So, it's thought that most stars, maybe all stars, are formed in stellar aggregations. And of course, the close proximity of other stars are going to have effects on planet formation and survival and et cetera. So some things to consider are the relevant timescales. So here I'm considering a cluster, which I sort of consider a proto-open cluster, relatively massive, 10 to the 4 stars, roughly 1.5 kilometers a second. Stellar densities of 10 to the third per cubic parsec. So these are probably roughly typical for proto-open clusters. And so there's two timescales that you really want to think about. One is just the disruption timescale, and so this is just the timescale for another star to come within, in this case, 10 AU of a star. And that's about a half a gig a year for these parameters that I've shown. And then, so planets that have orbits of 10 AU or probably even less are going to be likely disrupted on those sort of timescales. And so you'll have a population of free-floating planets which will eventually evaporate from the system, and they'll do that over roughly a relaxation timescale. Again, for these parameters, that's 0.03 gigas.
That's pretty hefty.
For a proto-open cluster, right? So the clusters we see now are considerably less massive than this. But often you see things like 10 to the third for an open cluster, or maybe even hundreds. Generally, this is for the visible stars. So if you go all the way down to M dwarfs, you get more stars. And now, obviously, open clusters have lost a lot of their mass by this point. So maybe it's a little massive. In fact, in this plot, I'm using something that's 6,000-7,000, and I think that's very reasonable.
But you're talking about clusters where in which stars form and planets forming
right.
and so on. Do we see them that
case? We see things like 30 Doradus, right? Which who knows what that's going to turn into, but that's pretty massive.
It's probably in a strange circumstance. I mean, you're seeing it around England.
Sure. I mean, all of these things you can scale with velocity dispersion, and so. I don't think that's right. I don't think that's right because you get a higher. I'll explain why. But you get a longer disruption rate if your velocity dispersion is lower. But then again, it's easier to capture planets. So
the lighter clusters just disrupt on a much shorter time scale.
So
that time scale anyway.
Okay.
But the critical thing is the central density and the velocity dispersion, not so much the body.
Right.
But you've got to have time for these things to happen.
That's right. So in my paper, I do this for three different examples. One is it's like 10 to the third stars, and it's a much lower star density. So you can look and see the results. It does change the answer, but not by, I don't remember by how much, not by an order of magnitude. Right. This is the least crazy aspect of this idea, right? So planets will be stripped, and they will eventually evaporate from the system. But there is a probability for one of them to come close enough to a free floating planet to come close enough.
Ask you a question about detection methods. I mean, you mentioned this was found, but through a transit, it's far away.
This one.
Does that mean that it could be like the only one? I mean, is it?
I'll go over what.
Like much bigger
than it is. I'll go over what this means in the next slide.
Are you going to continue on this star cluster aspect? Otherwise, I would like to make a comment on that.
You should finish this part before we begin
I knew I was going to get crucified for this. All right. So you have a free-floating planet in these clusters, and there's a probability for one of them to come close enough to... Well... We'll get to frequencies in a second. It's not as crazy as you think.
I think it's perfectly reasonable what you have said.
Right. Comes close enough to another star that it'll raise enough of a tide that it'll get captured. Okay. And so for 10 to the minus 3 mass ratio, the formal criterion is it has to come within 3 stellar radii to capture. Because they get stripped from...
First they get torn apart, and then it captures.
Right. So... my opinion is that this will happen. And the question is, I mean, there's nothing mystical about any of what I've said so far. It will happen. The question is, how often will it happen? Okay, so anyway, here's what I show. This plot shows in function of mass and period for these parameters. This is sort of the, this is the limit where you can capture planets. This is actually the circularization radius. So they'll get captured in a radius that's half, or they'll, their periastron distance will be half this, and then they'll circularize to this distance. And so this is where...
Circularize to this distance, so you've got to do that in the first place.
Just give me a second. One thing at a time. I will shoot down my own theory in time. Give me a chance. Anyway, this is the region where you'd expect to see tidal captured planets. Anything interior to this, they may decay. We can talk about how fast we think things decay on a shorter time scale, okay? So like I said, this does happen. I think it's pretty hard to argue that this won't happen at all. The question is how often. So a rough estimate, a very rough estimate, is just assuming these things, once these things are stripped, they stick around for a relaxation time in the cluster. So the probability that you'll capture one is the relaxation time over the encounter time, which is 10 to the minus 4, which is your very small fraction. Now, then the question is, will these things survive? Okay, and this, I think, is really the question of, is really the sticking point in this whole issue, whether or not this happens. Okay, so these things will circularize. They'll quickly synchronize, and then they'll evolve at constant angular momentum. So they have to absorb basically all the energy of this orbit, which is twice the capture radius. And so if you take the usual Q value and the usual circularization time, you find that they have to radiate of order 10 to the minus 4 solar luminosities. That's the amount of energy they have to get rid of. Okay. Now, will these things survive? At this point, I have to throw my hands up in the air. There are people that have very strong opinions about this, including the referee of the paper, who happens to be in this room. that say there's absolutely no way these things will survive. I don't think that that's clear. I think that there's, I think we don't understand.
There are calculations then.
Pardon?
No, there are calculations that's done. I mean, I don't know. First of all, let me declare, I'm not a referee of your
program. Right, he's not the referee of the program.
Okay, the second thing is that there are calculations that have been done with tidal dissipation inside the planet. And even at the limit of 3 days, if you have an eccentricity of 0.05, okay, 0.05, right. Not one, but 0.05, you're in big trouble.
Well, you'll inflate the planet, right? That's
it's
clear, that's going to happen.
When you come in, yeah, that's right, you're going to inflate the problem.
Right.
And there is a point that it goes through, you know, runaway inflation.
Right. So you're going to reach the Roche lobe, which is why I plot the Roche lobe here for our Jupiter and 2R Jupiter. You'll reach the Roche lobe, almost certainly, and then you'll dump mass. Then what happens?
There are two possibilities.
Right.
Either it goes, if you flow out from both L1 and L2, you die on the spot.
I agree.
If you flow out from L1, which is only possible if the eccentricity is relatively low, okay, not at the higher end limit, then you go out, you retreat out to larger semi-gas, you wouldn't stay there. That's the problem.
Well, I mean, you retreat out until you stop.
But the inflation will keep you going until you have a runaway deflation.
Yeah, Doug,
but that is way out.
Doug, you say there's a calculation, but you know, would you actually believe?
Right. I mean, like I said, I'm not a theorist, and if anything is clear to me, it's that the how energy is dumped or put into the planet due to circularization is not a well understood problem. I mean, there's lots of different calculations. People get very different answers, and I think the jury is still out.
If you put it all in the atmosphere, you'll blow the hell out of the atmosphere.
If you put it all in the atmosphere at once, right?
But it will blow the hell out of the atmosphere.
I agree. If you put it all in at once, but you don't put it all in at once.
But the point is that there's a lot of angular momentum as well as energy. It's not just energy you can radiate, but the angular momentum you can't. You can't put it into a very small region.
Actually, the angular momentum is more probable.
No, you have to circularize this.
No, but that's okay. No, the angle.
But if you only put it inside a tiny atmosphere.
I rest my case.
No, because look, as it's got down there, it'll just, the orbital expand. The angle momentum essentially is conserved.
Yeah,
it evolves.
I'm talking about where you dump it. You dump it, whether it's in the interior of the planet or in the surface of the planet. If you put it more in the surface area, okay, a tiny layer on the surface area, and that material can't take on all of this angle from the orbit.
It will you'll blow it out.
But there are arguments, okay? Norm would just come out with argument. We say that if you come to the surface here and you just radiate, the interior doesn't adjust, okay? But you can't do that with angular momentum, and that has also deposited angular momentum to that region.
But Doug and Rosemar, we also have simulations that show that there is a steady flux of planets going down, at least, say, by one order of magnitude due to the scattering processes in the star cluster. So there is a flux of planets.
No, that's we're
not
talking
the problem.
About, that's not the problem.
Please let me finish my sentence. It would be very kind, actually. So it's the problem is what is the time scale with which the scattering processes then destroy the planet? And could you just give some information about that? I mean, are you saying it's just one orbit and then it's gone?
No, it's not one orbit.
If it's more than one orbit, then there is a certain chance to see an object like that.
No, but you have to circularize, as I said. The circularization from point greater than 0.05, I'm not talking about one, okay? I'm talking about 0.05 from even a 3-day period. A 1.2-day period is even worse, a lot worse. Because the dissipation rate goes interior to the fourth power. A lot worse. Okay? It's not the problem of when your first get captured. That's not the problem. It's the finality that's the problem.
I don't know what this orbit is circular for this planet.
it's basically known to be pretty circular.
Observationally, I don't think it's all that well tied down.
It's not very well tied down, but you see radial velocity points, it looks basically circular.
Well, actually,
it's consistent with zero, but...
Right. It is consistent with zero, right?
Well, as long as it's only one object, I think it's not such a big worry. But well, we have to look in the data. You can get things like that.
So, I mean,
if it's only one,
if it's a point mass, what you said is certainly true.
Yeah,
if you can get rid of the energy from the surface, as Norm would suggest, that's certainly true. But there are calculations where people do these that are. I mean, the point is the entire, even if you are able to synchronize the top layer, the entire planet has to absorb most of that angular momentum. And there's a differential motion will propagate that energy transfer into the interior.
Well, actually, I was thinking that also the energy transfer is done by the encounter. That is the point.
Are you worrying about the internal structure or not?
No, I'm just worrying about the time scale. And you have this object, just for a short time scale, it will die due to what you say. But you have a certain chance to observe a thing like that. I mean, if it's just only one.
No, this star is old, so this happened long ago.
So this thing really does have to circularize and survive in order for this to be a viable mechanism to explain this planet.
If there's any fraction of the tidal energy that's being dissipated in the interior thing,
right.
It's going to pop up.
Right.
It's going to overgo this Rorschach overflow. And then the question is,
what happens then?
It's a magic to balance the flow outside L2 versus L1 to keep it just in the right spot.
Yeah, it's fine tuning.
But
it's not in the cluster anymore, and it's now pulled into the system.
I think that's the position would be if you could come up with some slightly more plausible mechanism, you'd be much happier.
Right. And also, I mean, just the question, there is this question, if you can deposit energy at the right location, you get rid of it, okay? And without effect, you won't affect the internal structure. That's okay, too. But how can you dump all that energy at the very top layer? You have to do it at the very top layer. As you go to the interior, the envelope expands. This energy is 10 to the 4 or 5 times larger than the current cooling rate of Jupiter.
Yeah, it's got to get rid of a lot of energy. So.
Who's done these calculations you keep referring
to? Oldhammer and who? And yours truly.
But I mean, I don't know. I personally think that I mean, I'm not an expert in any of this, but you know, I've read this paper that you're talking about, and you know, I considered it. But I've seen enough different opinions on what goes on that for me, it seems hard to believe that this thing's going to survive. But it's for me not out of the question, and you have to balance this sort of unbelievable scenario versus, you know, some other scenario that you come up with for why this thing stops at 1.2 days. So I think it's premature to just sort of throw it out immediately.
The other issue is also even more interesting, I think, is why does it go so slowly? I think Fred had done these calculations even in 1996 and mapping out all of the orbital decay time scale. And I believe that if you take the typical dissipation rate from the standard type of Scion type of calculation, and that time scale, orbital decay time scale, would be about 10 to 8 years.
This is the line for Scion.
1.2 big year, right?
This is the line for Scion. This linear. So this is where the reduction in the dissipation is linear with period over the convective time scale. Right, that's what the linear is. This is the Goldreich.
Okay, but it's
the quadratic. So
my recollection from Dimitar's plot was that the two lines straddle the proton.
No, he has three plots. One is an empirical one based on circularization. That one's basically right out. Then this is the Zahn, and then there's the quadratic.
So, but the Zahn result, you should take it with a grain of salt in the following sense.
I'm not taking any results.
Cannot explain.
I agree.
The circularization of binary stars, for it fails by two orders of magnitude.
Which,
so if you
take
that two orders of magnitude as an empirical scaling.
Right.
Okay.
Then this planet cannot exist. Yes.
No. That's
totally true. For the lifetime of this star, if you use the empirical result, that's what Sasolov showed.
Right? No,
that's what Dimitar showed.
Okay. But the point is that result depends on the argument of the classical, sort of this dissipation through its equilibrium pi, essentially.
Right.
Okay. Now, if it happens to have dynamical pi, if that circularization is primarily due to a lot of dynamical pi, there are frequencies, as Gordon showed, there are regions you get resonances, and there are regions you can trap them in between resonances, which you don't evolve very much. Okay, so it's possible that that guy can stay there, but I think not from the standard constant frequency independent.
I agree. So, anyway, it's clear to me there's a lot of unresolved issues as far as the physics goes here. Okay, so the question is, if this thing does survive, so if you'll bear with me a little bit longer and say that there's, by some miracle, this thing does survive, what is the probability that we would have seen this? And this turns out to be basically about right, as far as I can tell. So the number that you'd expect to see, so Ogle looked at 50,000 stars, in a flux-limited survey, and the number that you would expect them to see is just the probability of capture times the number of stars times some fudge factor, which I'm calling F, which includes the number of these stars that are main sequence and the number of stars that are formed in clusters, and who knows what this number is. But so the number that you'd expect to find is roughly 5 times this number F. And transit detection is then just this number times the probability of transit, which is about 25% or 20%, so you get about 1. Now, then the question you might want to ask is, well, why do they find 1-day planets and not 3-day planets? So for a magnitude-limited transit survey, the number that you'd expect scales is the period to the minus 5/3. And so if we say that there's, like the local neighborhood, 0.5% or 0.1% of stars have 3-day period planets, then the ratio of the number of one day period to 3-day period expected in the Olga survey is about half. And since they actually do see one 3-day period planet, or they see one 3-day period candidate, this is not unreasonable. Whereas for radial velocities, this number is more like a tenth. So it seems basically consistent that you would see a 1-day period planet in the Ogle survey and not the radial velocity surveys, assuming this mechanism. So so anyway, that was a lot rougher than I expected it to be. Aww. But it could have been a lot worse. No. Oh, go ahead.
Go back.
Yeah.
You're not done yet. You should have said that.
Yeah.
A different point I want to make.
Yeah.
That's the reason why I might want to believe that you can circularize. Look at that line that you drew parallel to the
right.
Static Roche limit.
I drew this line for you, Fred. You should say thank you.
Goes along the points at the edge of the tile, right? Mm-hmm. Now, what would give you that? Well, it turns out, I've done these calculations now recently with Josh Faber, the static Roche limit, which is the line to the left, let's say the planets are 1 or Jupiter, okay, when they're coming in. The static Roche limit to the left turns out to be also precisely the point where you get disruption of the planet. It comes in on a highly eccentric orbit or parabolic orbit. So if you were to scattering planets,
right.
If you were to scatter them in, say, following an interaction or an instability at some large distance, bound planets now I'm talking about,
right.
And you scatter them in, of course, in these highly eccentric orbits, that static Roche limit that you drew on the left, that's as close as they can get without being disrupted.
Right.
If you then circularize them, they will circularize at about twice that. And that's exactly where your line on the right is. And, I wouldn't
say anything yet at this point, but if you get a couple more points that are right on this line, it starts smelling really good. Now, I don't know how you keep that planet from destroying itself if it's coming in at a highly eccentric orbit and it's got a circle like
that. I don't either.
But, you know, maybe at some point we'll have to find a way.
All right.
You got a good deal.
Thank you, Fred. Said much better than I could have said.
You want to speak to your first referee, I think. Don't request Bill Blinn as your...
I thought I had gotten the worst referee when it came to title capture. Clearly not. Fred's referee. All right. Change of topic. This is a little less crazy. Maybe I'll get... Maybe people will be a little easier on me for this one. Okay, so this is... this. Right. So... So this is a project I'm just starting off with, so I haven't really gotten very far, but I'll just sort of give you a taste of what I'm thinking about. And so this is about binary KBO. So, you know, recently it's been discovered that maybe 5% of known Kuiper Belt objects seem to be in binaries with separations of greater than an arc second or half an arc second or something. So this 5% number is pretty approximate. And this is maybe a bit surprising. They have properties that are very different than binary asteroids, for example. They're separated by, you know, many thousands of kilometers, and some of them, or one of them at least, is on a very eccentric orbit. And so there's a variety of different theories that seem to try to explain where these binaries come from. There's a paper by Weidenschilling, and then also a paper by Goldreich, Lithwick, and Sari. And these first two papers argue that the binaries are primordial. They've invoked slightly different mechanisms for how they formed, but they both require a very massive disk to start off with in order to get the frequency that they observe. And then there's a paper by Fanato et al. Who suggests these maybe aren't primordial, but are binaries that are formed through exchange reactions from closer primordial binaries. And so all of these theories, as far as I can tell, offer very different predictions for the binary frequency as a function of separation and as a function of size of the binary. For example, the Goldreich, Lithwick, and Sari predict that when you get to very small separations, essentially everything is in a binary, and even some things are in triple systems or hierarchical systems. So the question would be, you know, if we could probe the binarity in different regimes, closer binaries of larger KBOs or the binarity of smaller KBOs, maybe we could distinguish between these various theories and maybe say something about the primordial KBO disk. So probing smaller separation large KBOs is hard, just because we sort of reached the limit of our resolution. Here's a binary KBO, null at all. This is from HST. So we can't really get much better resolution than HST. You might hope to do this with occultations, but the probability is very low. You have to look at a lot of them. They're not all in the same place, so it's a lot of work. But maybe we can look at smaller KBOs by looking at occultations. So just to remind you what the occultation properties of occultations of important things to remember about occultations of KBOs. One thing is just the time scale of these occultation events. So you're just looking for, you know, occultations of background stars by foreground small size Kuiper Belt objects. So the time scale is just the diameter crossing time. And this velocity here is for objects at opposition is mostly the reflex velocity of the Earth. At quadrature, it can be much smaller velocity, so the time scale can be longer. You get events that last from 0.1 to 10 seconds. The interesting thing here is what's really the probability of this happening. So that's just the optical depth, which is just the integral over the surface density times the area over the size distribution. And so using the recent Bernstein et al. Measurement of the size distribution of KBOs, you get a number that's sort of depressingly small, 10 to the minus 11th for objects of radius greater than 0.1 kilometers. This is sort of the limit you can expect because you get diffraction effects when you get much smaller than that, as I'll go into. But fortunately, this is really, ta-da. So there is a solution. Fortunately, these things are moving very quickly. So the event rate is actually quite a bit higher. So the event rate is just twice the optical depth, some geometric factor divided by the mean time scale of these events. So for 0.1 seconds, it's 0.05 a year. This is actually quite a bit smaller than numbers you may have heard bandied about occultations, and that's only because Bernstein et al. Threw a little, you know, a little water on the fire of occultation surveys by showing that there's many fewer smaller KBOs than you would get from a naive extrapolation from 100-kilometer-sized objects. So Taos is a project, a Taiwan-American occultation survey. There's PI is Charles Alcock, which is the goal is to try to detect small Kuiper Belt objects through occultations. And so they expect to have a time resolution of 5 hertz and get accuracies of sort of 10%, and look at 2,000 stars over the course of a year. So the number they'd expect to detect in this naively, you know, roughly, is just this event rate times n star, which is roughly 10 per year. So it's not great, but you know, it's enough to maybe start to do some statistics, especially if you do this over several years. So you'd expect, you know, depending on the theory that you're believe in for the origin of these Kuiper Belt objects, you might expect a number of binary Kuiper Belt object occultations. So one of the things I'm looking at is just what do the light curves look like. The things that you care about are the radius of the primary and the secondary, which here, just for fun, the secondary is an ellipse, the primary is a circle, just to try to throw a little bit of realism on the situation. And so these are the two parameters. You might also care about the Fresnel wavelength, which in this case, you know, for 500 nanometer observations, the distance of 40 AU is 0.7 kilometers a second. So you get these pretty diffraction spikes. You get some weird interference. If you look at this closely, you get these sort of little islands of interference between these objects, and so you get this. So one of the things, so you know, this is basically as far as I've gotten. This is stuff done with Chengguo Han, but we're trying to estimate detection rate as a function of the relevant parameters and see if Taos has any hope of trying to measure the binary frequency robustly and maybe distinguish between these theories.
Do you have to assume a mirror size here?
A
mirror size.
Mirror size, no.
Well, when the...
I don't think so.
When the diffraction... What is the diffraction limit in terms of getting your image size if that start to become small compared to...
Yeah, but these are sort of...
Individual images.
These are, you know, half-meter telescopes, so... The diffraction limit for an individual image is for a point source is very, very small, much smaller than these things, I think. Okay. All right. So something a little more near and dear to my heart. It's where I sort of got my start, and that's the idea of trying to detect. Well, it's planet detection with microlensing, specifically the idea of detecting Earths with microlensing. Okay. So just to. You know, remind you, the way you detect planets with microlensing is that you say that the microlens star, which creates two images of a background star. So here I show the source position at several different positions. Here's the source at several positions. Here's a lens star. It forms two images. One image moves like this. The other image moves like that. If this lens star happens to have a planet, it's in the path of one of these images. The gravity of the planet will perturb the light from these images. And then you'll get a little blip on top of your microlensing event caused by the planet. And so that's how you detect planets with microlensing, relatively simple. Now the nice thing about microlensing is that the signal that you get is sort of to zeroth order or to first order independent of the mass ratio. So I show that here. I have a planet that I'm sitting here and I'm growing the mass ratio of the planet from 10 to the minus, I think it's 10 to the minus 5 to 1. And you see that the signal is very high, even at very low mass ratios, and the only thing that changes is the duration of the signal gets longer. And so the duration, so the mass ratio here, 10 to the minus 5, this is for typical situations towards the galactic bulge where our lens stars are slightly less massive than the sun. So this is 10 to the minus 5 for the Earth. The time scale is roughly 2 hours for an Earth mass system, and it goes as the square root of the mass, or the square root of the mass. So the signal doesn't actually go down in amplitude, but it gets briefer and it gets rarer. The probability is a few percent. The probability of detecting Earth on a given light curve is a few percent, and the probability of having a microlensing event at all is just the velocity dispersion of the bulge divided by the speed of light squared. So that's 10 to the minus 6. So that means that you know, one out of every 10 to the 8th stars you'd expect roughly to have an Earth mass planet signal on it, if every star has an Earth mass planet. Now, like I said, the signals are large, but In fact, if the size of the Engel size of the star, the background source, is larger than the region of deviation, then you'll wash this out, this large signal out. So that means you require main sequence sources. So all you have to do to detect Earth mass planets with microlensing is you need to monitor about 10 to the 8th main sequence sources continuously with sampling less than 1 hour in reasonable photometry. Okay, so no problem. But the nice thing is that I'm going to argue is that you can do this from the ground, and there's really no other way suggested to detect Earth mass planets from the ground, as far as I can tell, at least robustly for a large number of planets. So the surface density of main sequence stars in the galactic bulge is about 10 to the third per square arc minute, and so you need an area that's roughly 28 square degrees in order to detect this, to get this many main sequence stars. Actually, it turns out to be slightly less than this for various reasons, but that's roughly the order of magnitude that you expect. So what I did with Andy Gould and Chenghe Han is to actually try to simulate what you get, what the returns would be from some massive next-generation microlensing survey. We have 4 2-meter telescopes situated optimally, Chile, Australia, South Africa, and Hawaii. And each one has some massive, you know, very expensive, but you know, less expensive than a satellite camera, which is a 4-square-degree field of view camera, which has 0.2 arc second pixels. So it says it's a huge 1.3 gigapixel camera. And so we assume 4 fields with 40 minute sampling, and we assume that we're monitoring the bulge continuously while it's less than 2 air masses from these sites. And so you have to take into account all sorts of ugly and disgusting things like weather, air mass, visibility, sky, moon, seeing, unresolved sources, the angular size of the source, detailed galactic model, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So you can see some of these things. So here's a simulation of a light curve, and here's a close-up of the planetary deviation. You see all sorts of fun things, like here's where the moon is high. You see the variation of the error bar with seeing. You see different sites do better. This is Australia, whereas this is South Africa. So Australia typically has poor seeing, so you do worse as far as the background noise. And so that, all of that is folded in. And so here's a signal that you get from an Earth mass planet at 2.5 AU. It's a huge whomping signal. Delta chi squared in this case is 2,000. So we used our detection criteria of 160 for the delta chi squared, and this is basically what we come up with for a five-year survey with these parameters. This is an optimal survey. So this is mass. Jupiter masses is a function of semi-major axis. There's Jupiter, there's Earth, Venus, Mars. And here's the rough limit for SIM, 1 microarcsecond. Here's radial velocity, 1 meter per second. And so here's lines of constant number of detections, assuming every single star has a planet at this given position. So you see that we'd expect to detect roughly 30 Earths at 1 AU, maybe 100 Earths at 2.5 AU. And we even have some sensitivity down to Mars. So I don't know, how much time do I have? It's hard to tell because, you know. So,
I think it's between you and the swimming pool for.
Is there no one going after me?
Well,
you have added the endless pleasure to this morning.
Okay. All right. Well, let me just do one more thing. And I'd like to compare this to other methods, just to give you a feel for how this measures up. So here I show the cumulative number of planet detections, Earth mass planet detections, as a function of the signal to noise detection for 4 different possible methods. So one is this microlensing survey that I just showed you. And here are the assumptions that I've used. So for SIM, I've assumed that every star has a planet of Earth mass at a period of 3 years. I assume that it's spending 2,000 hours over the 5 years of the SIM lifetime, systematic error of 1 microarcsecond. Here's Kepler. I assume every star has a planet in the habitable zone. I use the Kepler parameters, radial velocity. Every star has a Earth mass planet of 0.5 years. Again, I'm assuming some massive yet unfunded radial velocity survey for dedicated 2-meter telescopes, which is gives a total of 60,000 hours a year, 1 meter per second. And then microlensing, it's what I assumed before. Every star has an Earth mass planet 2.5 AU. So you see, this is the number as a function of the signal to noise threshold. And so at low signal to noise thresholds, which are generally what is conventionally discussed as detection limits, 8, microlensing, SIM, and Kepler all seem to work basically the same. They'd expect a couple hundred detections of Earth mass planets. However, I'd like to argue that signal to noise threshold is pretty unrealistic. especially for these sort of next generation cutting edge surveys that are trying to detect something that no one's ever seen before. So just to sort of help convince you of that point, here's probably the least believed detection of an extrasolar planet via radio velocity is Epsilon Eridani. It certainly has the lowest signal to noise of anything that's been claimed as a detection. This thing has a signal to noise of 13. Now, if you look at that, and if someone, you know, launched a whatever, $500 million satellite, came back and gave you a bunch of things that looked like this and said, look how many Earths I found, I don't know about you, but I'd be a little bit nervous. I'd be a little nervous. So, I'd like to argue that maybe signal noise threshold of somewhere around 25 is maybe a little more realistic. And if you pose such signal noise thresholds, you find that things like Kepler and SIM are going to detect a lot fewer planets at those signal noise thresholds, maybe of order 10 each. Microlensing does a little better because all the sources are at the same distance, so you don't have these volume effects that you get, which causes these things to drop so dramatically. So
the situation is perhaps a little pessimistic. Here I show a similar plot, except now I'm showing the number of planets as a function of the period of the planet. And I'm assuming all methods have the same. Every star has an Earth mass planet with a given period, so each technique now, as opposed to the previous plot, is confronted with the same number, same type of planetary systems. And so at the conventional signal noise thresholds, everything's happy. We get, you know, hundreds of detections. Kepler does better closer, obviously. SIM does better farther. Microlensing peaks right around here. But at the signal noise thresholds that I'm arguing are probably more realistic, things are pretty depressing. And in fact, at the period of the only known terrestrial planets, which is roughly 1 year, the combined yield of microlensing, Kepler, and SIM, you know, assuming all of these things are funded, launch, and work, would only be maybe 5 Earth mass planets with periods of 1 year. So that's pretty depressing. And I guess I'll end on that pretty depressing note. Thanks.
As you know, I was once a very strong advocate of the ground-based microelements.
Right.
Then an inordinate amount of time traveling was always.
Right.
But now I'm a member of guest.
Right.
Science team. And I think a much more lucrative and profitable scheme is to search for planets by microelementing from space. And I wrote a paper. It's a propaganda paper, essentially, for guests, comparing the yield of planets from a space-based observation scheme versus a ground-based scheme. Well, the problem with ground-based scheme is coverage. That's the main problem. It's true that if you distribute telescopes around the world, in the southern hemisphere, maybe four, you can pass the event from one telescope to the other. But you can only do that for a limited amount of time during the peak of the world season. Okay? Because after a while, you start getting light, which is going to decrease the amount of your coverage very much. And I can't remember the details, but I can make a presentation for this.
But I mean, it's important to note that the paper that you wrote was for a very different kind of microlensing monitoring. What you're doing, what you were talking about was alert and then follow-up, which I agree 100%. You just don't have enough time to do that. What I'm talking about here is a very different form of monitoring, and this is just, you know, monitoring and detecting at the same time.
But why do you do that? Because you spend most of the time trying to find even the candidate that has a microlensing period.
No, that's...
And why not do the follow-up? I mean, it seems to me to be a much better strategy. Let the smaller telescope try to pick out the microlensing event, and then you go, you know, have a follow-up.
It's demonstrably much less efficient. It's surprising, but I can show you why. It's demonstrably much less efficient to do it that way when you start getting to the regime that we're talking about here. So in this case, if you can get, as Bohdan Pachinski would like to say, if you can get enough pixels, then you don't even have to worry about this finding and then following them. You just have to, you just do it all at once in a big field of view.
This is not repeatable, right?
The, well, yeah, but neither is Kepler or SIM, so.
No, the advantage.
Yes, you see it. No, no. This is a very important point. So I'd like to make this, because this is something that often is said about microlensing. Once you detect an Earth mass planet with Kepler, there's nothing you can do to follow it up from the ground. All you have to do, the only thing you can do is launch another Kepler to prove that it exists. Unless, you see it four times with Kepler, and that's it. You never see it again, because you cannot detect this from the ground. You cannot do radial velocity follow-up. There's nothing you can do to prove that this planet exists, except
prior information.
You have a set of candidates for later missions.
Right. So you have to launch something similar or better quality to Kepler to do it.
But suppose you discovered it with Kepler, and then don't you have this prior information? You know exactly what period it is and what the phase is, and then try to do a much better ground. I mean, the problem really is to follow up, you find the period at random, but if you already know a particular light curve pattern to follow
right
on the ground,
the best ground-based photometry ever been demonstrated, as far as I know, is millimagnitude photometry. You're talking about something that's of order 100 times less than that.
What about differential photometry?
It may be. It has never been demonstrated that you can do photometry from the ground at that level. I'm not saying it's impossible.
I agree. You know, in terms of the absolute photometry.
Differential. I'm saying the best relative photometry ever been demonstrated from the down is at 10⁻³ level, roughly. It's just really hard to do photometry much better than that for a variety of reasons.
I think the chief virtue of the microlensing circuit.
Right.
Get the followers.
And that's what I'm.
It's going to tell you how many planetary
right.
systems, what fraction of stars
right.
have planetary systems like our own.
Right. And it's essential for TPF to know this number.
Okay.
Otherwise, you cannot build TPF.
But why couldn't you do follow up? Because suppose you say, okay, you know, the signal really goes down. But if I have a fantastic resolution, I look at one of his maps. Okay. Look at the brightness distribution. Even after this thing has gone through the peak light curve, couldn't I, you know, take an image of this region?
No.
If I had a
suppose you have a microlensing event and discover that you got a
right. So now I do the 2D thing, the map of the.
What 2D thing? I don't understand.
If you detect the planet, you might be able to see the star
right.
About which length about which the right. planet is orbiting. But you would never see that planet.
Right. You might be able to see the star.
I can look at the distortion of the image, right?
No.
Suppose I look, if I have a true image, I mean, suppose, you know, I have less than microarcsecond image. I'm just thinking about, you know, if you have TPF, I have a microarcsecond image capability. And after the thing passed by, I look at the sky and I say, that image of the star is not. Quite right.
Absolutely not. These things are at 5 kiloparsecs away. There's just not this. It's 2.5 arcs.
I've worked it out at once. It's about the distortion. It's about microarcsec. Okay. It's about microarcsec
distortion.
Distortion of what?
Distortion of the image. Okay. If you look at the image, you're able
due to what?
Resolve. You're able to resolve these
by
images.
I mean,
right?
All I see is the image of the star.
What yeah. The distortion of the image due to what? I don't understand.
Because, you know, in the sense that the disk of the star is already resolved, okay?
No.
No.
Not at all. These stars have microarcseconds in size.
Well, they're a few kbc away, right? Yeah, it's microarcseconds in size. And if you get down to the microarcseconds in size, even after it passes, could you not have distorted enough to see it? I mean,
what is the distortion?
What's causing
gravitational distortion? Gravitational lens. We see the distortion.
Oh! So he's talking about the splitting of the images. You can see this. You can see the splitting of the images, but that just gives you the mass of the primary, and therefore you know the mass of the planet.
But I also know something about the planet, right? Because the planet also has a little bit of distortion. If I follow a few days afterwards,
it gives you the mass of the planet. That's all it gives you.
right? But could I not?
No. The planet will move the images around by order its Einstein ring radius, which is 10 to the minus 3 of the primary Einstein ring radius, which is a milliarcsecond. So it moves the images around by microarcseconds, and that's only during the peak of the perturbation. So you're not going to confirm that this planet exists. You may measure the mass of the primary by measuring the splitting between the images, which will give you the mass of the planet instead of just the mass ratio. But it's not going to give you a confirmation that the planet exists. So there's really, it's very difficult to confirm that this planet exists once you see it with microlensing. Right. I agree. It's the statistics. And that's what I argue, is that you're going to get a lot of high signal-to-noise detections with this.
So how much, guest, I presume, is much, much better even.
I
actually disagree with that statement.
I can't remember the detail. No, not necessarily.
I disagree with both of those statements, but I'm not on the guest team, so you can talk to both of us and see which one you believe.
Scott, was the numbers that you had in mind there, if you detect zero, what upper limit does that place on the fraction of stars
occurring? For microlensing, or?
Whatever you had in mind in your four telescope thing there.
Well, I mean,
something very reasonable.
So, you know, you'd expect, so 100 Earths. So if you see nothing, right, so that's an upper limit of 3.
Oh, but that was 3%. 2.5 AU, that's
right, so you want 1 AU? Tell me what you want. I mean, you just take this number, so take 3 divided by whatever the line is, and that's your 95% confidence upper limit.
So within the fact of a few, it's the same with, say, half an AU would degrade.
Yeah, so it's really hard to do much closer than 1 AU for microlensing, because the Einstein ring radius is about 2.5 AU. That's why you do best there. The mean Einstein ring radius is 2.5 AU. So you really don't, if you want to say something about the abundance of terrestrial mass planets inside of a half an AU, use Kepler. Kepler will do fine for you. But at 1 or 2.5 AU, microlensing, at least in this survey, will do much better.
So it's about 1% if you detect 0 of that order.
A little bit. It's a few percent, I guess. 95% confidence level. I agree.
Okay. Well, thank you very much. Well.